Synopsis of Lecture 2. Psychology, based upon anthroposophical worldview, as a foundation for teaching. Concerning the empty concepts of modern psychology. The central meaning of thinking and willing. The pictorial character of thinking. Reflection of prenatal experience. The will as a seed for spirit-soul reality after death. The transformation of prenatal reality into thoughts through the power of antipathy. The increase of this power to memory and concept. The increase of the sympathetic power of willing to imagination and living pictures. Blood and nerves, the tendency of the nerves to become material, the tendency of the blood to become spiritual. The intertwining of sympathy and antipathy in the brain, in the spinal cord, and in the sympathetic nervous system. The threefold aspects of the human being, head, chest, and limbs. The interactions of these three aspects and their relationship to the cosmos. The development of willing and thinking through pedagogy. End of synopsis, beginning of Lecture 2, given at Stuttgart, August 22, 1919. In the future, all instruction must be built upon psychology, developed from an anthroposophical understanding of the world. Everyone recognizes that instruction must be generally based upon psychology, and that in the past, for example, the widespread Herbartian pedagogy based its educational methods on Herbart's psychology. In the last centuries up to the present, a certain factor inhibited the rise of a genuinely useful psychology. This can be traced to the fact that in our age, the age of the consciousness soul, we have not achieved the spiritual deepening that could cultivate a real understanding of the human soul. However, those psychological concepts formed from the knowledge of the fourth post-Atlantean period are today more or less without content and have become clichés in the realm of understanding the soul. If you look at a modern psychology book or at anything to do with psychology, you will find it has no true content. You have the feeling that psychologists only play with concepts. For example, who forms clear concepts of thinking or willing today? You can find definition after definition of thinking or willing in various psychological and pedagogical works, but such definitions can give no real picture of thinking or willing. Due to historical necessity, people have completely neglected to connect the soul of individual human beings to the cosmos. People are not in a position to understand how the human soul relates to the cosmos. You can get an idea of human nature only when you can see the relationship of the individual human being to the whole cosmos. Let us look at what is normally called a thought. We must certainly develop thinking, feeling, and willing in the children. Thus, we must first develop a clear concept of what thinking is. Those who objectively look at how thoughts live in human beings will immediately notice their pictorial character. Thoughts have a pictorial character. Those who would seek something existential in thinking, who would seek real existence in a thought, fall prey to a great illusion. What would it mean if thoughts had their own existence? Without doubt, we do have existential aspects. Take, for example, the features of our physical body. Parenthesis, what I have to say here is only of a rough nature. Parenthesis. Take, for example, our eyes, nose, or stomach, all of which are existential features. Although we live in these features, we cannot think with them. The essence of your own being is expressed in these features. You identify yourself with them. However, the fact that thoughts have a pictorial quality and are not so integrated with us that we are part of them gives us the possibility of comprehending something. Our thoughts do not actually exist. They are only pictures. A great error was made at the end of the last human developmental period when existence was equated with thinking. Quote, cogito ergo sum, end quote, is the greatest error ever placed at the head of the modern worldview. In the full compass of cogito there is no sum, only non sum. This means, so far as my cognition is concerned, I do not exist, only a picture exists. When you examine the pictorial character of thinking, you must focus upon it in a qualitative way. You need to see the mobility of thoughts. In a sense, you need to form an inadequate concept of activity, which nonetheless somehow resonates with existence. However, we must recognize that in the activity of thinking we have only pictorial activity. Thus, everything that evolves through thinking is the metamorphosis of pictures. However, pictures must be pictures of something. They cannot just be pictures. If you reflect upon the image in a mirror, you could say that the image appears in the mirror. However, what is in the image is not behind the mirror, but exists elsewhere quite independently. It does not at all matter to the mirror what it reflects. All kinds of things can be reflected in the mirror. If we know that thinking is a pictorial activity exactly in this sense, then we must ask, what do our thoughts depict? Of course, conventional science can tell us nothing about this, only spiritual science can help. Thinking is a picturing of all our experiences before birth or before conception. You cannot come to a true understanding of thinking if you are not certain that you have lived before birth. In the same way that a mirror reflects spatial objects, your present life reflects your life between death and a new birth, and this reflection is your pictorial thinking. Therefore, when you think of it pictorially, you must imagine the course of your life to be confined left and right between birth and death. Furthermore, you must imagine that thought images from before your birth continuously play into it and are reflected by human nature. In this manner, in that the activity you undertook in the spiritual world before birth is reflected by your physical body, you experience pictorial thinking. For those with sufficient insight, thinking itself is proof of pre-birth existence, because it is a picture of this existence. I first wanted to put this out as an idea, we will return to an actual explanation of these things later, to make you aware that in this way we can free ourselves of the definitions found in works on psychology and pedagogy. I also want to make you aware that we can come to a true comprehension of thinking when we know that thoughts reflect the activity of the soul in the pure spiritual world before birth. All other definitions of thinking are useless, because they do not give us an idea of what thinking is. Now we want to turn in the same way to the question of will. For normal consciousness, the will is extremely baffling. It is the nemesis of psychologists simply because they view the will as something very real, but basically without true content. If you look at the content psychologists ascribe to the will, you will find this content always derives from thinking. Considered alone, the will has no actual content. It is also the case that no definitions exist for willing. To define the will is even more difficult because it has no real content. But what is will, really? It is nothing other than the seed within us of what our spirit-soul reality will become after death. That is, if you imagine what our spirit-soul reality will be after death, and if you picture it as a seed within us now, then you have the will. In our drawing, the course of life ends on the side with death, but the will goes beyond that. Thus, on the one side, we need to see thinking, which we must comprehend as a picture of prenatal life, and on the other side, willing, which we must comprehend as a seed for something later. Consider the difference between seed and picture. A seed is something super-real. A picture is something sub-real. A seed will only later become something real. It carries in it the characteristics of what will be real later. Thus, the will is, in fact, of a very spiritual nature. Schopenhauer felt that, but he was unable to recognize that the will is the seed of the spirit soul that will develop in the spiritual world after death. You can see how soul life is, in a certain way, divided into pictorial thinking and seed-like willing. Between the picture and the seed lies a boundary. This boundary is the life of the physical human being, who reflects prenatal existence and thus creates pictorial thoughts, and who prevents the will from maturing, thus keeping it a seed always. We must therefore ask what forces are active here. Clearly, certain forces must exist in human beings that cause the reflecting of prenatal reality and inhibit the germination of post-death reality. Here we come to the most important psychological concepts of my book, Theosophy, namely the reflections of antipathy and sympathy. The reader speaking, the book Theosophy is also on the website as a free download. End of my aside. Back to the book. We are in the physical world now because we could no longer remain in the spiritual world. This is the connection with the first lecture. To the extent we are in the physical world, we develop an antipathy against everything spiritual. Thus we reflect prenatal spiritual reality as an unconscious antipathy. We carry the force of antipathy in us, and through it transform prenatal experience into a mere mental picture. Sympathy is our connection to the reality of the will, which radiates into our existence after death. We are not directly conscious of these two things, sympathy and antipathy, but they live in us unconsciously. They represent our feeling, which exists in a continuous rhythm of the interplay between sympathy and antipathy. Our world of feeling develops in us as a continuous interplay, systole, diastole, between sympathy and antipathy. This interplay exists continuously in us. Antipathy goes in one direction, continuously transforming our soul life into a life of ideas. Sympathy goes in the other, transforming our soul life into what we know as our deeds of will, into the seed of what is spiritual reality after death. Here we arrive at a real understanding of spirit-soul life. We create the germinal soul life as a rhythm between sympathy and antipathy. What is it that you reflect in antipathy? You reflect the entire life, the entire world that you lived through before birth. This primarily has a cognitive character. You therefore owe your cognition to your prenatal life shining in to your life after birth. The cognition that is present to a much higher degree as reality before birth is weakened to a picture through antipathy. Cognition comes into contact with antipathy and is thus weakened to a pictorial thought. When antipathy is strong enough, something quite special occurs. In ordinary life after birth, we could not think pictorially if we did not use the force that remains with us from before birth. If today, as a physical being, you can present things to yourselves in pictures, then you do so not with your own power, but with the force still active in you from the time before birth. You might think that this force ceases activity with conception. However, it remains active, and we think pictorially by using this force that still radiates into us. You have in you on an ongoing basis the living experience from before birth. Only you have the strength to reflect it. It encounters your antipathy. If you now think pictorially, then every such picture encounters antipathy. And if the antipathy is strong enough, memory is created. Thus, memory is nothing other than the result of antipathy active in us. Here you have the connection between undifferentiated reflection of emotional antipathy and the concrete reflection, the pictorial reflection carried out by the activity of perception in memory. Let me read that sentence again. Here you have the connection between undifferentiated reflection of emotional antipathy and the concrete reflection, the pictorial reflection carried out by the activity of perception in memory. Memory is only heightened antipathy. You cannot have memory if you have such great sympathy that your thoughts for your thoughts that you swallow them. You have memory only because you have a kind of disgust for these thoughts, which prompts you to reflect them and bring them into consciousness. This is their reality. When you have gone through this whole procedure, when you have pictured something, reflected it in memory, and retained this picture, then the concept is created. In this way, you have on the one side of soul activity, antipathy, which is connected with your prenatal life. Now take the other side, willing, which is the seed within us of life after death. Willing lives in us because we have sympathy with it, because we have sympathy with this seed that develops only after death. Just as pictorial thinking is based upon antipathy, willing is based upon sympathy. If sympathy is strong enough, as when thoughts become memory through antipathy, then imagination is created through sympathy. Exactly in the way that memory arises from antipathy, imagination arises from sympathy. If your imagination is strong enough, and in normal life this occurs only unconsciously, if it is so strong that it permeates your whole being right into the senses, then you have the normal pictures which enable you to think of external things. Just as concepts arise out of memory, the living pictures that provide sense perceptions of things arise from imagination. They arise out of the will. A major error perpetuated in psychology is the belief that we look at things, create abstractions from them, and then arrive at a picture. This is not the case. That we perceive chalk as white, for instance, arises out of the use of the will, which through sympathy and imagination becomes a living picture. In contrast, our forming of a concept has a quite different origin, because the concept arises out of memory. This describes the soul. You cannot grasp human nature if you do not grasp the difference between the sympathetic and antipathetic aspects of human beings. The sympathetic and antipathetic aspects, as I have described them, are expressed in the world of souls after death. There, sympathy and antipathy exist undisguised. I have just described the human soul. On the physical plane, it is connected with the human body. Everything connected with the soul is revealed in the temporal body. On the one side, the body expresses antipathy, memory, and concept through the nervous system. Prenatal life organizes the nervous system in the human body. The soul experiences prior to birth. Let me read that again. The soul experiences, prior to birth, act upon the human body through antipathy, memory, and concept to create the nerves. This is the proper understanding of the nerves. All talk about a differentiation into sensory and motor nerves is, as I have often mentioned, nonsense. In the same way, willing, sympathy, imagination, and living pictures work in a certain relationship to the human being. This is connected with something seed-like that must remain seed-like and thus may never come to a real conclusion, but must disintegrate at the moment of creation. It must remain a germ and never go too far in development. Thus it must perish in the moment of creation. Here we come to something quite important in the human being. You must learn to understand the whole human, spirit, soul, and body. Something is continuously formed in the human being that always has the tendency to become spiritual. But because people egotistically love it so much, they want to hold it in the body, and it can never become spiritual. It dissolves into their living physical bodies. We have something in us that is material, but continuously has the tendency to slip out of the material state into a spiritual state. We do not allow it to become spiritual, and thus we destroy it the moment it desires to become spiritual. This is the blood, the counterpart to the nerves. There are two pictures. On the left picture, there's a down arrow with the word nerve at the bottom of the arrow, and to the left, going down the arrow, as it were, are the words cognition, then below antipathy, then below memory, and below concept. On the right is an arrow pointing up with blood at the top, the words I'll read from the bottom up are living pictures, up imagination, up sympathy, up willing. Blood is truly a very special fluid. Were we able to remove it from the human body so that it would still remain blood and not be destroyed by other physical agents, which of course is not possible in earthly conditions, it would whirl up as a vortex of spirit. Blood must be destroyed so that we can hold it within us as long as we are on the earth, until death, so that it does not spiral upward as spirit. We continuously create blood and destroy blood, create blood and destroy blood, through inhaling and exhaling. We have a polaric process in us. We have those processes that run parallel to the blood, parallel to the bloodstream, and continuously tend to lead our existence out into the spiritual. To speak of motor nerves in the normal way is nonsense, because motor nerves would actually be the bloodstream. In contrast to blood, all nerves are predisposed to continuously die and become physical. What lies along the nerve paths is actually excreted material. The nerve is actually an excretion. Blood always tends to become more spiritual, and nerves always more material. This is the polarity. We will take up these basic principles in later lectures and see how, when we follow them, they can help us shape instruction in a healthy way, so that we can educate children for soundness of body and soul rather than for decadence of spirit and soul. There is so much failure in education because so much is not recognized. Physiologists believe that they are onto something when they speak of sensory and motor nerves, but they are actually only playing with words. They speak of motor nerves because people cannot walk when certain nerves are damaged, for instance, those in the legs. They say someone cannot walk because the nerves that set the legs in motion, the motor nerves, are paralyzed. In truth, that person cannot walk because he or she really cannot perceive his or her own legs. Our age has of necessity become lost in a series of errors, so that we can have the opportunity to work our way through these errors and become free human beings. Now, think about what I have just shown, that the essence of the human being can be understood only in a connection with the cosmos. When we think, we have the cosmos in us. We were in the cosmos before we were born, and our experiences then reflect in us now. We will again be in the cosmos when we go through the gates of death, and our future life is expressed seed-like in what occurs in our will. What works in us unconsciously works quite consciously in the cosmos as higher cognition. We have a threefold expression of sympathy and antipathy in the bodily revelation. In a certain sense, we have three centers where sympathy and antipathy play into one another. In the head, we have one such center where the interaction of blood and nerves, through which memory arises, occurs. Everywhere nerve activity is interrupted, everywhere there is a gap, a place exists where sympathy and antipathy interact. For example, another such gap is to be found in the spinal cord, when one nerve goes toward the posterior horns and the other away from the anterior horns. There is another such gap in the ganglia embedded in the sympathetic nerves. We are not at all the uncomplicated beings we may seem. In three places in our organism, in the head, in the chest, and in the lower body, there are boundaries where antipathy and sympathy encounter one another. In perception and willing, it is not so that something is led from a sensory to a motor nerve, but rather a spark jumps from one nerve to another in the brain and spinal cord and thereby touches our souls. In these locations where the nerves are interrupted, we are connected with our sympathy and antipathy in our bodies. We are also connected where the ganglia develop into the sympathetic nerve system. We are connected with our experience in the cosmos. Just as we unfold activities that are to continue in the cosmos continuously unfolds in us the activities of antipathy and sympathy. When we reflect upon ourselves as human beings, we see that we ourselves are the result of cosmic sympathies and antipathies. Of ourselves, we develop antipathy, and the cosmos cultivates antipathy together with us. We develop sympathy, and the cosmos cultivates sympathy with us. As we appear physically, we are clearly divided into the head system, the chest system, and the abdominal system, including the limbs. Please consider that this division into separate parts can be very easily attacked because of the modern fondness for systematizing. People want to neatly delineate each individual part. If you say that we differentiate between the human head, chest, and abdomen limbs, then people will be of the opinion that each of these must have its own well-defined boundary. People want to draw lines. Let me read that again. People want to draw lines when they differentiate. But when we speak of reality, this is impossible. In our heads, we are mainly head, but we are head in our entire being, only the rest is not primarily head. In the same way that we have actual sense organs in our head, we have them all over our entire body. For example, the sense of touch and the sense of temperature. When we perceive temperature, we are all head. In our heads, we are mainly head. Elsewhere, we are simply head in passing. In this way, the various parts intermingle, but it is not so easy with the limbs as pedantic people would like. Thus, the head is a continuum. Only in the head it is particularly well formed. It is the same with the chest. The chest is the actual chest, but only in the main, since the whole human being is also chest. In the head, there is something like the chest, and also something like the abdomen and limbs. The parts are intermingled. It is the same with the abdomen. Physiologists have also noticed that the head has qualities of the abdomen. The highly defined development of the head nerve system is not found in the outer cortex we are so proud of, but under it. The beautiful structure of the outer cortex is, in a sense, a degeneration. It represents more of a digestive system in the outer portions of the brain. People need not be particularly proud of the mantle of the brain. It is more like a degeneration of the complicated brain into a more digestive brain. We have the mantle of the brain so that the nerves having to do with cognition can be properly nourished. The reason our brain is better developed than an animal brain is that we can feed the brain nerves better. Only in this way, namely, that we can feed the brain nerves better than animals do, do we have the possibility of more fully developing our higher cognition. However, the brain and nerve system have nothing at all to do with actual cognition. They are only the expression of cognition in the physical organism. We may ask, ignoring the chest for now, why do we have the polarity between the head and the limbs abdomen? We have it because at a particular point in time the head was, quote-unquote, exhaled by the cosmos. The human head was formed by cosmic antipathy. When the cosmos is so, quote-unquote, repulsed by what human beings have in them, that the cosmos expels it, then this form is created. Let me read that again. When the cosmos is so, quote-unquote, repulsed by what human beings have in them, that the cosmos expels it, then this form is created. Human beings carry a representation of the cosmos in their head. The roundly formed human head is such a picture. Cosmic antipathy creates a picture of the cosmos outside itself. That is our head. We can use our head as an organ for our freedom, because this head was previously expelled from the cosmos. We do not properly understand the head if we think of it as being integrated into the cosmos in the same way as our limbs, which are connected with sexuality, are integrated. Let me read that again, sorry. We do not properly understand the head if we think of it as being integrated into the cosmos in the same way as our limbs, which are connected with sexuality, are integrated. Our limbs are integrated into the cosmos, and the cosmos draws them in and has sympathy with them in the same way that it has antipathy for our heads. In the head, our antipathy collides with that of the cosmos. Our perceptions arise in the collision of our antipathies with those of the cosmos. All inner life occurring on the other side of the human being arises from the loving, sympathetic embracing of our limb system by the cosmos. Thus, the form of the human body is an expression of how the human soul is created from the cosmos, and what is received from the cosmos following this separation. When you observe things in this way, you will more easily see that there is a tremendous difference between the development of will and that of thinking. If you particularly emphasize the development of thinking, you actually direct the entire human being back to prenatal life. You will injure children if you educate them rationally, because you will then utilize their will in something they have already completed, namely, life before birth. You may not mix too many abstract concepts into the education you bring to children. You must bring in more pictures. Why? You can see the reason in our table. Reader aside, the table he's referring to is on the book on page 57. It's the description of those up and down arrows I mentioned earlier. End of my aside. These pictures are living pictures that go through imagination and sympathy. Concepts are abstractions, and they go through memory and antipathy. They come from life before birth. If you use a lot of abstractions with children, you will stimulate them to concentrate particularly intensively upon the formation of carbonic acid in the blood, and upon the crystallization process in the body, upon dying. If you bring children as many living pictures as possible, if you educate them by speaking in pictures, then you sow the seed for a continuous retention of oxygen, for continuous development, because you direct the children toward the future, toward life after death. When we teach, in a certain sense we again take up the activities we experienced before birth. We must see that thinking is a pictorial activity which is based in what we experienced before birth. Spiritual forces acted upon us, so that a pictorial activity was sown in us, which continues after birth. When we present pictures to children in teaching, we begin to take up this cosmic activity again. We sow pictures in the children, which can become seeds because we cultivate them in bodily activity. As we, as educators, develop our capability to act through pictures, we must continuously have the feeling that we work upon the whole human being, that we create a resonance in the whole human being when we work through pictures. To take this into our own feelings, namely that education is a continuation of supersensible activity before birth, gives education the necessary consecration. Without this, we cannot educate at all. Thus we have learned two conceptual systems, cognition, antipathy, memory, concept. Willing, sympathy, imagination, living pictures. Two systems that through their specialized use can further our practice of education. End of lecture 2.